Tonight on Standing Room Only, This Muslim American Life and Special Education Forum.
Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
On October 19th, writer and professor Mustafa Bayoumi talked about what the war on terror looks like from the Muslim American perspective. The first half of today's episode is a continuation of the last Standing Room Only broadcast, when Bayoumi gave four tips for writing Muslim characters. Tonight, he continues with the fifth.
Number five, be sure to have at least one good Muslim character, preferably one good one for each bad one. People then will say your film or book is balanced, when in fact, as you know, its function is more akin to an alibi. Besides, 50-50 are pretty good odds that half of all Muslims are terrorists. See above. Six, black Muslim characters. Excellent idea. Also valuable in film because African-American men look angrier when wearing kufis. And African-American women are very photogenic in white hijabs. However, and this goes for both books and films, be careful not to have too many of them in major roles. This will only confuse the viewer slash reader if the Muslim character's rage derives from race or religion. Number seven. When establishing the Muslim character's motivation for the deplorable act to come, make sure the US government is responsible for some reprehensible action in the past, either at home or abroad. Strive for moral ambiguity. The only thing better than moral ambiguity is contrived moral ambiguity. Number eight, when you have good American Muslim characters, make sure to exaggerate their Americanness. Playing sports like football or basketball and consuming bubble gum pop culture are good for this. Number nine, when you have bad American Muslim characters, make sure to exaggerate their foreignness. Spicy cuisine and suicide vests are good tools for this. Number 10, there will be sex. Muslim men are very charming and very sexy until they kill you or someone else. Then they must become less charming and sexy. If a Muslim woman is sexy, she must have a domineering father from which she seeks to escape, often, though not necessarily, with help from her infidel boyfriend. Since Muslim women should wear hijabs only in family, such Muslim women should wear hijabs only in family situations and always awkwardly. And number 11, white converts hate their families and America. What kind of list was this, I thought? Was this for real? Had Mustafa, in his own Muslim paranoia, just made this up? Or had someone else written this list and passed it off to him as authentic and he fell for it? Who the hell was Abdul? Had Daniel Blake written this too? I was getting nowhere thinking about the rules. So instead I pulled out Thou Shalt Kill from my backpack and began reading where I had last left off. Detectives Berardino and Patrice were again on the case. And Mustafa Bayoumi was already back in Pittsburgh. He had gone to a Steelers game at Heinz Field wearing a suicide vest. Amazingly, Detective Berardino had figured out Mustafa's evil plot just in time and was frantically calling Patrice, who coincidentally was at the stadium. Quote, Mustafa Bayoumi, he's there at Heinz Field. He's going to blow himself up, but Berardino told Patrice. And in the book, it constantly refers to uses both names. It always says Mustafa Bayoumi. It's so weird to read Mustafa Bayoumi. As I was reading, I found myself hoping Berardino was wrong. But I knew he wasn't. The mood was tense. Would Patrice find Mustafa and stop the terrorist attack that would kill hundreds of people? I would be lying if I said that my heart was not pounding. Perhaps Patrice then went to the control room first to talk to the stadium staff. Quote, we've already checked the ticket sales roster, said one of the stadium staff. There's no record of a Mustafa Bayoumi. He then used the security cameras to scan the crowd. Quote, he ran his eyes from screen to screen, skimming the sea of faces. Bayoumi's skin tone alone wouldn't be enough to mark him out. Bayoumi looked more black than Arab. That's what it says, again. And plenty of Steelers fans were black, this book tells us. But Patrice finally spotted Mustafa in the bleachers, and that's when it became clear that the young detective had no choice. I understood, even sympathizing with Patrice's position, and yet somehow I felt sorry for Mustafa, though I knew I shouldn't. Quote, 2 minutes to go, 3 points between the teams, Steelers on offense, second and 10, 32 yards out. Patrice looked through the crowd and got a fix on Mustafa. There, Mustafa, his mouth working furiously, talking to himself, praying. Patrice ran to Mustafa's row of seats, pulling out his gun and frightening the crowd. I continued reading. Quote, Mustafa turned toward the commotion at the end of his row and saw Patrice, pistol held in two hands, front and center, bead drawn on Mustafa. I knew what would happen next. Quote, Patrice squeezed the trigger faster than thought, and Mustafa's head exploded. Not all of him, just his head. Split like a watermelon and gone in puffs of blood. I had to reread those last sentences. Patrice squeezed the trigger faster than thought, and Mustafa's head exploded. Not all of him, just his head. Split like a watermelon and gone in puffs of blood. Oh, his head exploded. A powerful feeling of melancholy started to tremor through me, like a moving subway car shaking on the tracks. There were still 100-odd pages left in the book, but instead of soldiering on, I found myself staring straight ahead, my mind as empty and sad as a blank sheet of paper. I closed the covers and sat in silence. Mustafa Bayoumi is dead. Long live Mustafa Bayoumi. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for this very stimulating and engaging presentation. And I'm sure we're going to get some questions and comments from the floor. The floor is now open. Well, let me ask a question of you. I think you rightly pointed to the role of the media and how pervasive it is in forming, stereotypes and certain images that become forever fixed in people's minds, even as you said, when they've never actually encountered an Arab or a Muslim person, right? What is an effective way of pushing back against that? There's lots actually that we can do in our own classrooms. I think we get, impressionable young people, students, very bright, very engaged, and willing to learn. I mean, that's certainly a venue where we could be very effective, but I'm thinking in terms of the larger public sphere. What are your ideas or your thoughts on that?
I mean, I think we live in many ways, we live in an interesting time, in an interesting moment, because we have more opportunities to set a media agenda, probably, than we have in any time in the past. Mm-hmm. Due to the nature of social media, due to the nature of the internet and blogging, and there are several examples of people who have moved from the blogosphere into the mainstream as well. And so there are opportunities there, and I think that people should be maximizing their own critical literacy skills and be willing to push back, especially in the social media circles that we have out there. On the other hand, though, what we also have is the demise of a public sphere in many ways, and the growth of narrow spheres, a bunch of competing private spheres. So this is part of the reason too why it's both a double-edged sword, having more opportunities to speak, but then what happens is that people are entering their own kinds of echo chambers at the same time. So what you have is a very clear sort of right-wing social media world, and you have very clear left-wing social media worlds, and it divides along many different axes along those ways too. So I think the other side of that too is being able to try to articulate a kind of critical media literacy that is deliberately trying to pass over those boundaries, those kinds of borders. So you're not just speaking to people who you already are already like-minded, and trying to find ways to speak to others at the same time.
I'm just wondering how you create those opportunities, though. How easy is it to reach out to those alternate spheres?
I mean, you need a sort of thick skin to do a lot of social media stuff, frankly. Not everybody is equipped necessarily for it. But I think it's also, it doesn't only happen in social media either. People often will ask me, what should I do? When the Muslim bans were coming down, for example, I was giving a bunch of talks, and there was a very real desire to be part of a social change movement. There was the constant invocation of, what should I do? And my answer often is, I think you should do what you do best. I think that all of us, and each one of us, has his or her own individual talents. And why not use, what you're doing doesn't mean that, your being political doesn't necessarily mean that you have to feel it's some kind of duty or responsibility to go and march on the front lines whenever there's a march. Although those can be fun too. I went to a bunch of the marches. The Women's March was really inspiring and a blast. I had a great time, among other marches at the same time. But it's not only being politically active does not just mean that you should take some of your free time and then be out on the street. It also means, I think, thinking about the ways in which your energies and your abilities are being used towards formulating the kind of society that you yourself want to live in. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that you have to become the best person on Twitter or the most, the sort of Facebook moment of the day or what have you or something like that. It can just mean, maybe you have really great skills in making short documentary films or something like that. And then you should be willing to and try to seek out audiences that are not just like-minded audiences for those kinds of venues too. So I think it's a matter of being able to maximize your own potential within a larger social world rather than just thinking about maximizing it for your own self.
You mentioned contrived moral ambiguity in the story.
Yeah.
Are there any representations in books and movies of Muslims that you approve of, or are we just so tainted by war on terror culture that it's basically hopeless?
Well, you should read my books. After that. I'm thinking for specifically, a lot of that was, I was writing a lot around homeland when I was writing that list. Mm-hmm. So you might hear a lot of homeland in that list, because I think homeland's attempt to try to have some kind of moral question was so contrived at the same time that the show was so flawed and deeply racist. So that doesn't get it off the hook, this sort of contrived moral play, the sort of passion play that's behind it. So I was thinking specifically of I think Homeland when I was writing that. And I think that we're still waiting for really good representations, frankly. I think that there's still a lot of problems. Let's talk about, for example, the ones that have been lauded and applauded as being moving the narrative forward. I think maybe the one that is the latest representation of that would be A Night Of. Do you know the HBO show? The Night Of or A Night Of? The. Yes, The Night Of, yes. And how many of you saw the show? Anyone? Not very many, which is interesting too. But I have problems with the show too, even though it was trying to be, I think a little bit more sensitive to sort of Muslim American issues and minority issues. It still is essentially a white savior narrative. It's still this white lawyer who still is able to come in at the last minute and save the brown boy. So I still think that we need a lot more work out in the public sphere, in the sphere of the imagination. You know, there are some that are better than others. I mean, I think, for example, a book from several years ago, maybe a decade old now, maybe more even, by the Australian writer called Richard Flanagan, called Terrorists, I think it's called, which is actually a good book. But it's not an American book, for example. I haven't read Camilla Shamsi's new book, but it seems to be getting a lot of praise. So maybe there's some hope there. So there is a growing body of work. So I think that's something that's good. And I think that there's more recognition that there has to be more narratives out there. You know, during the, in late January, there was a movement, a professional movement even, among literary agents. A bunch of them put out a call saying, in response to the travel ban, to the Muslim ban, saying, we want to represent more Muslim authors. So if you want to pitch us stories that are Muslim specific, then please feel free. So that has some potential there. But I still think that the representations still tend to be, on the whole, pretty paper thin.
If you were to design your own show or your own representation, what type of narrative would you spin? What type of story would you write if you wanted to create, a show for the American audience, which had better representation of people of Muslims in general?
Well, for one thing, I'm sure that, as somebody who's Muslim American, I'm sure that there are other Muslim Americans in the audience. Like, my life does not revolve around a ticking time bomb terrorist scenario. I don't know anybody who's a terrorist. So there has to be a way in which the stories that are told are not seen through the national security lens, even through the victimization of the national security lens, which is far more common. Many, many more people, right, will be impacted by national security policies, right, than because they are threats to national security in the country. So that imbalance, I think, has to be recognized on one level. But on another level, it's also just about stepping away from the national security paradigm as a whole. So I think it's important to, as I was saying this afternoon too, I think now we're seeing a lot of mobilization on behalf of the DACA people, for example, right? But there's this thing in American culture, it seems like, where American culture will only allow you to be a one-issue person, everybody. So DACA people become DACA people. And in the American imagination, they're probably all from Latin America, right? But there are, I think the fourth largest country impacted by DACA is South Korea. There are many, I know many South Asians, Muslims, who have been impacted by DACA in New York City, for example. And so, you're talking about two different law enforcement regimes crashing down on you, and that's not uncommon, that these things can happen. In all kinds of difficult ways. I know somebody, people who are African American and who are Muslim, for example, that can be a complicated situation to live through and live in all kinds of ways, but in really interesting ways. Like, I think the kinds of representations that accept and investigate everybody's multipleness, the multiplicity of everybody's identities, will be an inherently more interesting way of representing the world than thinking, okay, we need to have a Muslim character, we're going to put her in a hijab to make sure that everybody knows that she's Muslim, right? And then we'll have her pray, but she'll have her shoes on for some odd reason when she's praying, or in Homeland, I'm back to harp on Homeland, but in Homeland there's what's one scene where he's praying with his shoes on, right? And
it's all in the details, isn't it?
Yes,
John.
So personally, I find it hard to believe that, like, if you were to survey educated people, a group of educated, like college educated people, they wouldn't agree that the majority of Muslims are peaceful, right? And so the rebuttal in a discussion like this is, but the peaceful majority doesn't matter, right? They don't affect my life. It's the 1%, it's the 0.001% extremists, and that's why it's in the media. That's why those are the whole high profile incidents. So how do you combat that in terms of, like, because I just find it hardly surprising that, like, after 9/11, like, Muslims are going to be discriminated against. Like, because it's just like you have, it's a human tendency to put people in a box, right? So how do you combat that with, like, those things in mind?
But it's also a human tendency that I think that as a nation, we had tried to overcome, right? As a national movement, we had thought that we had overcome it, or we had at least spoken the words that we had overcome it. Because the thing about Muslim Americans and the threats around Muslim Americans now is that there was really no idea about Muslim Americans prior to 9/11, and now Muslim American is this idea in the American culture, and it's a suspicious idea. It's the first creation of a community of suspicion in the post-civil rights era, right? In an era where we're supposed to treat people individually and not as a collective. Now, that was aspirational. I know that there's all kinds of problems with that, but you have to challenge people on their aspirations, I think, for one thing. And on the other level, too, I mean, you can just point out the hypocrisies of it all, because we don't judge all white people on the basis of the actions of a few white people. And why is it that we can think that, you know, I mean, that, like, that's so blatantly hypocritical, and why does that get to stand, whereas it doesn't get to stand for Muslims? And so I think challenging people on their own hypocrisy and on the limits of their expressed values is a way of going forward.
I want to just make another comment. I also wanted to ask you, like, I think when we talk about issues like this, the tendency is to want to be optimistic about the direction that it's going. But, like, with my generation personally, I don't see an increased interest in educating yourself on Islam and Muslims in the Middle East. I see actually the opposite. I see more increased tendency to want to, like, have this us versus them mentality. Mm. So I personally, like, don't see the situation getting any better anytime soon. And do you?
I talked a little bit about this afternoon. Yeah, I don't think I see it getting better either. Because there's also something else there are competing, on certain days I do, maybe 2.5 days a week, I see it getting better. Which is to say, you know, because now I've been doing this kind of work for a long time. And I would say from 2001 until around 2014, 2015, whenever I was speaking in front of audiences, I would have to prove that Islamophobia is actually a force in American culture. Now it's a given. The audiences that I speak to understand, and the polling data shows this too. Most Americans, when polled, now agree that Islamophobia is a real thing, and it impacts the lives of Muslims in this country.
The term is actually used.
It is.
There was a lot of resistance before to actually using the term.
Yeah. So there's some, you know, I think that's an important, recognition is an important thing. So as the general public pays more attention to it, maybe there'll be opportunities to confront this. So there's a little glimmer there, you know, just like we saw with the Muslim ban people on the streets. But again, I was trying to suggest that, you know, I don't know, it's like we need to have more activity around these issues too. But on the other hand, there's something else I think that's really important here too. You know, I think that historically we've tended to see questions that are around minority rights or difference in the United States. We've tended to see those fundamentally as issues around domestic politics and the domestic sphere. Right? And so when we think that we can change, probably rightly so, that we can change the direction of the country if it's something to do with the domestic politics. We can pass civil rights legislation, we can have public service announcements, we can teach it through education in schools, all those sorts of things that are part of what our domestic life is like in the United States. Whereas we feel, I think, as a country, as a nation, generally that foreign policy is a lot harder to change in this country. And I think foreign policy is a lot harder to change. And there are established, you know, ways that foreign policy happens in this country. That's why you saw this incredible continuity from George W. Bush to Barack Obama, even though you would have thought probably that Obama would actually change the ways of the war on terror. There wasn't very much change. And I think we've seen with Donald J. Trump, he's actually pursued essentially the same foreign policy up until this point. The problem with that is that, you know, what we have in our very contemporary globalized world is that you can't really separate those spheres out very well. Not really very much at all. And what happens overseas directly impacts Muslims in the United States, directly. And that's something that they don't have a whole lot of influence over. Really none. I don't have any influence over what's happening in Raqqa right now. And so, but American foreign policy has a great deal of influence as to what happens overseas too, right? So, and that's why it makes Muslim Americans even more vulnerable in a way. It's not unique, you know, something like Japanese internment as being as a consequence of like the Japanese war, in World War II and the Japanese in World War II, you know, that's and Pearl Harbor, et cetera. Like that's, we've seen moments of this happen in the past and we'll probably see it with other groups in American society into the future as well. But understanding that relationship between foreign policy and domestic civil rights issues, I think is incredibly important as a way that we can also try to mobilize, frankly, a real anti-war movement in this country, you know, which is something that's sorely lacking.
We can take one more question, Riley.
You mentioned earlier in your speech that we aren't seeing a lot of people in the streets and that their energy is being zapped by their dependence on courts. What do you think it would take to start seeing more people be socially active outside of the Roulette?
I'm not sure. I mean, I think that we need to have a more sophisticated conversation about street activism. Like, I thought the whole thing about the way that the Charlottesville and it was so simple-minded, the way that that was talked about, and the way that people talk about Antifa and all, I think is pretty simple-minded. I think we want to have a more complicated way of talking about what street activism looks like, because I think that the way, like, you know, I'm not even talking about Trump and saying, you know, they're both blame on both sides and all that stuff, but I think that that narrative in a way ends up dominating, right? And so that will scare a lot of people away. Whereas what, you know, if you look at some of the more sophisticated accounts, you'll see that, you know, a lot of those, the left-wing opposition movements really saved a lot of people at Charlottesville. That's one example. But I mean that just as a way of trying to understand street politics with more sophistication than I think American politics generally allows for. I had another thought, but now I've forgotten it. So what remind me of the question again?
More or less, what it would take to see people get back out of the streets.
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm really afraid that what it takes is catastrophe or near catastrophe, too.
Yeah.
Right? And so, I mean, are we really one major terrorist attack away from declaring martial law in this country? I mean, sometimes it feels like it. And there, I think that the Trump administration is becoming more sophisticated because what you'll see, you know, when the travel ban, January 27th, Friday night, the Trump administration issues its travel ban. And what you see was they did it after 5 p.m. on Friday, thinking that that would actually be a good time so people wouldn't pay attention, because that's a typical political way of acting, right? On the contrary, it was the weekend. It was something that was so egregious, and everybody was out, right? And it was like, and in fact, since then, people have gotten through FOIA requests documents from inside of the government that illustrate that the government was closely monitoring those protests, very, very closely, because they too were concerned about those protests. The government does not want those protests on the street. So I think what you've seen, when you think about it, if you think about the various iterations of the Muslim ban, if you think about the refugee ban that's part of the Muslim ban, which I didn't talk about today, which is also unconscionable, if you think about the ways that they're talking about leaving the Paris Accords, to any other, so many others of their executive orders, what the Trump administration is now doing is signing executive orders for actions that will happen in the future, not immediately. Right? And I think that that's deliberate. I think it's a way of defeating the people's mobilization. Because if something happens right away, there's a signature and it happens right away, people will react to it. You sign an order and it's not going to happen for another 3 or 4 months or 3 or 4 years, whatever, it's a lot harder to get people to come out on the street for that, right? And we don't know what's going to be like, when it's going to be like at that point. So they themselves, I think, are adapting. So we have to adapt as well. And you know, I think it means living more publicly in our protest. So that means protest is not just an online phenomenon. It has to be something that is in the real world at the same time. And I think, and I want that because, you know, for somebody who's been doing this for a while, frankly, it's a whole lot of fun. And you get to meet a whole lot of people and, like, you know, you end up, maybe I said this in a way, but you end up creating the society that you want, that you think that you're aiming for while you're doing it too. So I think it's really important that we be out there together and not just atomized on our phones.
So be part of the change. Right?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, thank you all for coming, and let's have another round of applause for our speakers.
You have been listening to This Muslim American Life on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to writer and professor Mustafa Bayoumi talk about the war on terror from the Muslim American perspective, including what it means to be Muslim American today. The remainder of the show takes us to a different event, Special Education in the Betsy DeVos Era, a panel discussion about meeting children's needs. This panel discussion was presented by the Indiana Coalition for Public Education. It was held on October 26th at the Monroe County Public Library. A continuation of this event will be broadcast in the next episode of Standing Room Only on November 22nd.
Hello, my name is Kathy Fuentes-Rohr, and I'm the chairperson of the Indiana Coalition for Public Education of Monroe County. Our organization has been around for about 5 years, and our goal is to inform the public about issues that face our public schools, give the big picture for the real concerted, well-funded, well-planned out attack on public education, and hopefully empower people to act on behalf of public education. So the reason why we were doing this forum in particular tonight is given the current climate of public education, with our Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, we know that the people in charge are not educators. From the federal level, looking at the state legislature, on down. And that has really harmful effects on children and teachers in the public schools. And some of the most vulnerable are children with special needs. The narrative is the money will follow the child as they choose charter schools or voucher schools or to stay home or to do online, but the fact is that their federal rights may not follow them. So today we have a great panel, but I will introduce my friend Debbie Fish, who's on our board and on our state level board of the Indiana Coalition for Public Education. And she will introduce our panelists.
Okay, so special education goes back a long, long way. And for me, it started in Monroe County Schools when I was a special ed teacher. And it was self-contained. And I did a little resource. And then I counted back, and I think it was 1992 when Monroe County Schools went to inclusion, and I got to do that. And if any of you are classroom teachers, how many are? Okay, listen to this. I had a caseload of 20 students and a full-time teaching assistant. That's pretty amazing. And it meant I had hands-on children every day and could really support them. And my greatest fear in all these years is that we're taking those things away. So I was a teacher, I did case conferences for 2 years solid. I had a foster son who had been in my classroom and then came to live with me for 5 years. And because I knew the ins and outs of what they're gonna help you share, I was able to not only tutor him, but get him out of special ed by the time he was in middle school and high school. And that's hard to do if you don't know the system and you don't know how to talk the language. So we're not gonna use a lot of jargon, I don't think, but we're gonna try to help parents, teachers, grandparents, why ever you're here and interested to know the current situation. And I'm sure many of you saw that DeVos rescinded 72 guidance documents. And they don't really know how that's going to all play out, but it's very concerning because it means that some of the laws may be more difficult for school districts to interpret and know what to do, and that can hurt children. So I'm going to introduce our panel. So the first one is Audie McCullough, and she's a medical receptionist who's learned how to be a strong educational and medical advocate for her son, Caden, and they currently reside in Bloomington, where they feel most at home and content.
So I will tell Caden's story to begin with. And I do want to let you know that he gave me permission to share this story. I want to start off by saying that Caden has some wonderful qualities. He is bright, caring, handsome, funny, and thoughtful. He has a love of video games, science, and Greek history is his new thing. So Caden has had quite a rough medical history in his young 12 years of life. So he has multiple heart defects. And the reason that I think it's important to start with the medical history is because it kind of shaped how things affected him later in the school system. So he was born with with heart defects that were very complex. And so he had his first heart surgery at 3 months old. The surgery lasted 14 hours, it was very complicated, and basically his heart couldn't handle it, so he was put on life support, and he was on this form of life support for 9 days, and it was very terrifying. And during this time, he had a stroke. So this caused a lot of physical weakness, muscle weakness. We didn't know at the time how much damage it had caused, but he did have a long hospital stay, and he ended up coming home with a feeding tube, a very long list of medications, and at 5 months old, he started with first steps. They were a godsend to us. So he had occupational therapy, physical therapy, speech therapy, developmental therapy from 5 months all the way until he was able to transition into a developmental preschool at three. And I really think that that early intervention was very helpful for him. Caden was hospitalized and had many ER visits over the next several years for pneumonia, asthma, bleeding issues, due to a bleeding disorder that we found out later on in life. He had surgery complications, heart catheterizations, 2 more open heart surgeries. The last one was a year ago. And all of these caused further delays and regressions, mainly because he spent time in the hospital instead of time playing with toys and at school. And so, you know, just doing typical child things, so he regressed. And when you have a child that is medically fragile, you worry about them constantly. When Caden was very young, I worried mostly about his health, but, you know, for quite a while, I didn't know if he would ever be able to walk, talk, eat, or write, because he was delayed in every area. But luckily, like I said, with the early intervention and awesome people in our corner, and his determination to fight, he now does all of those things. So we are very thankful. He does have the diagnosis of cerebral palsy, so that is something that affects him now that he's in sixth grade. He has some that affects him now, but it's very mild. So it affects his memory, his writing skills. He has some fine motor delays. He has a slow processing speed, and he wears braces on his legs. Caden also has ADHD, mostly the inattentive type, but this makes him kind of sluggish. It's hard to follow directions, hard to finish tasks, makes him forgetful, and he gets easily distracted. And unfortunately, I have to admit that over the next several years, we moved throughout we moved to different schools, and during this time, he had to go, basically he went to a different school every year. And so we tried the private school, the charter school, thank you, and the public school systems. And so we have the experience of all of those. And that wasn't because I wasn't educated in what those things meant or how they worked, but it was because I was looking for the best for him, and I didn't quite know where that was, and I truly wanted the best, so I kept fighting for that. And so, like I said, we started with the developmental preschool here in Bloomington, and this was a place that I really thought helped him to get things started. So First Steps was wonderful because they helped us to transition into the preschool. They went to his first IEP meeting, and they helped explain how the whole process worked. The developmental preschool teacher was very organized. She created a picture schedule, a social story. All of this was very helpful with helping him to transition into this new environment. After that, we moved up to Indianapolis. And Indianapolis is kind of a whole different ballgame than here in Bloomington. I don't want to go through every single experience that we had, but we did, in kindergarten, he did go to a charter school, and I'll be honest, we actually loved his teacher at this charter school. My sister worked at this charter school, and we didn't have a bad experience in this environment. The main reason that we switched out of this program was because we moved up north, and it was in a neighborhood that we felt was unsafe. We did at one point go to a private Catholic school in Indianapolis, and that is where I felt was the least best option for him, because I do remember them saying that they couldn't provide everything for every child with disabilities, so it kind of depended on how severe the disability was. They did have somebody come in and work with him on speech, and they had somebody work with him for OT, but just as like as an OT consult, so they didn't work with him directly. They didn't have a nurse there, which for us was a really big problem. And I've come to learn that public school system is the best place for him because of that. We need a nurse to be there. But in general, that situation just wasn't the best for us. And then eventually we moved back to Bloomington, and eventually we ended up back in the public school system, and it really just was the best for us because we discovered Binford, and we absolutely love it. He's been there for 3 years now, and they've done wonderful things for him. So he feels at home. His teachers, inclusion teacher, therapist, school staff have been supportive and willing to work with him. They're open to different ideas, accommodations. They're flexible with many hours he's had to, whenever he's had to miss due to surgery, appointments, etc. He's truly thriving in the best way that he can. He's receiving the help he needs, and he's generally happy.
Thank you, Audie. No child comes with instructions, at least none of mine did. I don't know about all yours. And when it's a parent with a child who has such challenging needs, you can see how monumental it is and where do I start and how do I do this. So will you join me? Went to IU, and her undergraduate degrees were in history and anthropology, but yes, she got her master's in special education. She saw the light. It's a calling, so something must have called you, right? And she has 18 years of experience working with individuals on the autism spectrum. For 2 years, she worked for a post-secondary academic and residential program designed for individuals with Asperger's syndrome and nonverbal learning disabilities. And for the past 9 years, she's taught students with moderate and severe disabilities in Monroe County School District at Jackson Creek Middle School. Katie's gonna now move to a little bit bigger picture and tell us about her classroom and her experiences with kids.
All right, first of all, thank you so much for sharing. I know how hard that is. It's your child is yourself, it's a part of yourself, and thank you for sharing a part of yourself with everyone here. I'll back up and talk a little bit about my background. So as was mentioned, I got my original degrees in anthropology and history and got my teaching certificate to do that at the same time because I was gung-ho about being a history teacher. It's just what I wanted to do. I thought, I'm going to enlighten young minds. It's going to be amazing. However, becoming a history teacher is rather challenging. There's a lot of people who want to be history teachers. So I did the whole getting in the doorway thing and became a paraeducator. Like, okay, that'll get principals will get to know me, administrators will get to know me, I'll get a job that way. So I became a paraeducator and worked in a couple different settings and worked with students with special needs, and it was eye-opening for me. There are younger people in this audience and older people in this audience, and I think some of the people in the audience my age and older know that when you grew up, there were a lot of kids you didn't see, and you didn't know that you didn't see them. They just weren't there. And it was interesting to have that experience in my young 20s to get to be around and work with students who I never saw when I wasn't that far away from being in high school, that I didn't see them there. And it did change my life. It was the eye-opening moment. It was going, I'm good at this. I like this. I like working with students who have a completely different set of challenges, and every single one's a puzzle, and I want to figure out what that puzzle is. So I started taking classes to go back and get my master's. I, at that time, also started working in Homebound, what MCCSC calls Homebound. And basically what that means is exactly what it sounds like. You're working with a kid at home and working out of their home and teaching them in that environment as well. And that was interesting for me because I got to see a little bit of what parents went through. I got to, because you work really closely with parents when you work in Homebound, and I got to see their struggles and what they wanted for their kids.
what they hoped, dreamed, and imagined. And it was a little bit different than what you think of when you go through teacher training. Parent training is a little bit different. Parent training is the big picture. Parent training is what's your hopes, and what you want your child to be happy, you want your child to have friends. And so that was a little bit more growth there to see that. Then after that, I worked for a school that taught individuals around the ages of 18 to 28 year olds who had autism, high functioning autism, Asperger's syndrome, which was a separate label at that time, and PDD-NOS, which is lovely for pervasive developmental disorder, not otherwise specified. You know, she said there would be no acronyms. I had to throw that one out there because it's basically, we don't know what's going on, but you got some social issues. All right. So I worked with students like that, and it was a cool experience because I got to see after high school. And that's something that we don't always think about. We focus on education, we focus on what are you going to learn, and we focus on all of these things that match up to the standards. And then I got to work with students to go, okay, but now we'd like to have a job, and we'd like to have a social life. And I worked with students who are also going to Ivy Tech and going to IU and seeing the struggles there. And it was interesting to see what they were prepared for, and it was interesting to see the things that they were not prepared for. And we helped them through that process. I was a liaison with people at IU and Ivy Tech in the special education departments there that helped work with students. And so I did that for several years, and then for the last 9 years, I have worked at Jackson Creek Middle School, and I currently work with students who are labeled to have moderate and severe disabilities. So there are three levels within the educational system for, that they put students with disabilities in these categories, and it is mild, moderate, and severe, and sometimes they're arbitrary, sometimes they're meaningful. It's a label that helps us to go, okay, really how much services do you need? What kinds of services do you need? And I work with the students who have the most severe disabilities within the district at the ages of 12 to 14, 15, which means that I work with students who are working on identifying shapes. I'm working with students who are working on counting to five. I'm working with students who are reading, but reading at very low levels. I'm working with students who for a lot of them, their focus is on life skills. Their focus is on learning how to go grocery shopping. Their focus is on learning how to stay focused. She's going, how do you teach that? So that's kind of what I do right now, but it's not really about me. When I want to talk about what I do right now, it's about a team. And that's the amazing thing about what I do right now, is I have some great paraeducators myself now, full circle there. I have a wonderful team, and it takes a team. I could not teach the students that I have if I could not have a team to do that. But what also people don't realize is that I have a team that extends beyond my classroom. Audie spoke a little bit about the people that helped out Caden. I work with an occupational therapist, an OT. I work with a speech-language pathologist, an SLP. I work with a behavior specialist. I work with a vision specialist. I work with a hearing specialist. I work with a physical therapist. All of these people are the team that work with my students. Because when you're working with students in special education, you cannot do it all. And I think that's an important factor that needs to be brought up here. One person cannot do it all. I do not have the depth of experience and knowledge that my SLP does about assistive communication. I don't have that, and she has the time to put into learning even more all the time to go to those conferences. I also don't know everything that my physical therapist knows about the best way to work with a student who's struggling to walk up and down stairs. But we work together. And that's one of the amazing things that I love about working in the public schools, is that you have the ability to have that team. All of these experiences have taught me something about looking at special ed as a whole, which is why I'm up here. I want to make it clear, I'm not up here representing MCCSE. I'm up here representing myself Katharina Cox, as my experiences that I just laid out to you in terms of all the different variety of experience I've had working in special ed. And something that, the couple things that I've pulled out of those experiences is one, every single parent wants what's best for their kid. Every single parent wants to make the choices they think will be the best for their kid. And that is true for students in general education population. It is extremely true for parents of kids with special needs, because you are faced with so many decisions to make. And one of those is, do I do the public school? Do I do the private school? Do I do the charter school? And that choice is a powerful one. And I think something to think about when we think about that choice is that, are we as well informed as we should be? Do we know everything about the choices that we're making? Because everyone has an agenda. And when there's money involved, there's definitely an agenda. So do we know everything that we're gaining when we choose the choices that we're making? Do we know what we're getting if we're going to that charter school or that private school? And is that actually the best for our child? But the other perspective that I want to bring to the table is that best for the community? And I know that that's something we don't want to think about, because, well, I want best for my kid. But something that I find to be extremely important in special education is that the community matters. I spent the last 2 days with two major events in Best Buddies, which is a program we have where kids without special needs get together with kids with special needs. And it was these huge groups. We had a pizza party one day, and then we did crafting today. And it was amazing, not just for the kids with special needs, but for the kids without. And it's important that we have a strong community, with, because the reality is not everyone's going into charter schools or private schools. The community that you're entering as an adult is going to, no matter what, primarily be based out of students who attended public schools. So we want to make sure that our public schools are everything, that if we're fighting hard for our students to be accepted and to be part of a community, the reality is that community is in the public schools. And that's something important to consider when we're looking at the big picture as well.
You've been listening to a panel discussion about special education in the Betsy DeVos era. The panelists talk about how to meet children's needs in schools. You've been listening to two panelists introduce themselves. To catch the other three panelists and a question and answer session with the audience, tune in to Standing Room Only on November 22nd.
Been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.